continue with classification and measurement. We have a series of papers on that issue, all closely connected. I give the floor to Julia.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everyone. At this meeting, the staff will present to the board a series of papers on the solely PNI condition. The objective of these papers is to clarify and to improve that condition. This meeting focuses on financial assets only. Financial liabilities are outside of the scope. It focuses only on solely PNI condition. Business model discussion is outside of the scope. And it only focuses on contractual cash flow characteristics. Impairment considerations are outside of the scope of this discussion. After the boards make decisions on the solely PNI condition, in response to the feedback received, the staff will ask the FASB board whether the FASB board would like to retain the solely PNI condition for classifying financial assets or pursue a different model. Other aspects of classification and measurement model for financial instruments will be discussed at future meetings. There are 7 papers and 2 appendices for this meeting. Agenda paper 6, memo 240, is just an introduction. Agenda paper 6A, memo 241, summarizes staff recommendations in all the papers and is provided for the board's convenience. Agenda paper 6B, memo 242, discusses amortized cost as a measurement basis. There are no questions for the board in that memo. Agenda papers 6C through 6F, memos 243, 246, are decision-making papers, and there are appendices A and B that explain staff proposals in those papers. What we would like to do today is to briefly walk the board through amortized cost paper, then explain the overall solely PNI condition using the flow charts, and then turn to decision-making papers and open the floor for discussion. So before I move on, do you have any questions on the scope of today's discussion or next steps?
So Julia made it very clear what we are not going to discuss today. That is already a big help. Any further questions?
Okay, then I'm turning to the amortized cost paper, which is agenda paper 6B, memo 242. This paper discusses mechanics and information content provided by amortized cost, and we make a number of observations which are summarized in paragraph 28 of this paper. Key observations are: amortized cost is an allocation mechanism that provides information about effective return on the financial asset by allocating that return over time. Amortized cost works best and provides useful information for financial assets with fixed payments. It also works for financial assets with variable payments, but in this case, both degree and source of variability become important. Amortized cost is not designed to and does not provide information about fair values of the financial asset. And therefore, just because an asset has a volatile fair value or a fair value of a particular feature of the asset, in themselves do not determine classification. However, in certain cases, they could be helpful indicators of whether the return on the asset is indeed basic lending type return, and this is explored in further papers. Do you have any questions or comments on amortized cost paper?
Any questions on 6B? Mark?
So Julia, this paper is really just for our benefit. You're not talking about describing amortized cost within the standard in this way, right? I mean, particularly the words like useful information. Like, that wouldn't go in the standard.
I suppose we could consider providing some discussion about amortized cost in the standard. And the reason I say that is because the feedback we heard from constituents indicated that having the objective for amortized cost would not only help the board in making the decisions on the solely PNI condition, but would also help constituents in the application of that condition.
Well, when you talk about amortized cost provides useful information, I just feel like that doesn't belong in the standard, because who's going to make the determination about whether it's providing useful information? Is the preparer going to? So this is just, it makes sense in the basis. It makes sense for us. But if we're going to put some stuff in the standard, that particular phrase just struck me as ineffective.
Any other comments?
Just one minor comment. If you put this in the basis, you're calling this a return as being consistent with a lending relationship. As I said in the Ed session, all the assets that we're accounting for here aren't loans. And so you might want to think about modifying that word in some way so that it applies to all the financial assets, including debt securities that are not loans, when you think about these issues.
One comment, I would caution, even in the basis, maybe not being quite as blunt as, for example, paragraph 11, where it says only provides useful information for certain investments. Cost might provide useful information for a host of investments beyond that. It just might not be as useful as fair value. So to say cost provides no useful information, I think we need to be careful about saying.
So noted?
Yes, all noted.
Yes? Okay.
So then moving on to the flow chart. There are two flow charts which are presented in the appendixes A and B. The top and the middle parts of the flow charts are identical, which reflects single staff recommendation on principal, interest, and particular contingent and prepayment features. The bottom portion of the flow chart is different, which reflects alternative staff view on particular contingent prepayment features. So starting from the top of the flow chart, before you even get into the solely P&I condition, there are two screens. The first screen is de minimis features, which are features that could only impact cash flows on a financial asset by a de minimis amount in all scenarios. And therefore, such features are disregarded for classification. So this screen is about magnitude of the impact on cash flows. The other screen is non-genuine features, which are features that are highly abnormal, extremely rare, and very unlikely to occur, and therefore they are also disregarded for classification purposes. This is a probability notion, and it already exists in IFRS 9 and in the FASB proposals. So once features pass those two screens, we move into solely P&I condition. And there are a number of boxes in the middle of the flowchart that describe the decision tree, but I would like to start with the big box in the very middle of the flowchart. The solely P&I condition is all about basic lending type return, which is repayment of principal and interest on that principal. So the question becomes, what is principal and what is interest? The staff conclude in the paper that principal is the amount transferred by the holder for the financial asset on initial recognition. On the topic of interest, the staff conclude that time value of money and credit risk are typically the most significant components of interest. However, they are not the only possible components. And for example, liquidity risk and profit margin and costs associated with holding the asset could also be consistent with that basic lending type return. The next question is time value of money. And the staff concludes in the papers that the objective for the time value of money is to provide compensation for just the passage of time, absent other risks and costs associated with the asset. As a general proposition, there must be a link between the tenor of the rate and the period for which the rate is set. However, even if this link is modified, if there is an interest rate mismatch feature, or the entity uses average rate or lagging rate, it can still meet the objective of providing consideration for just the passage of time. And in this case, an entity will need to make an assessment whether this is the case. And an entity could make this assessment in a qualitative way or quantitative way, and the staff believes that in many cases, qualitative assessment will be sufficient. If an entity performs a quantitative assessment, the staff proposes that the current, not more than insignificant threshold in the proposals is replaced by significant threshold. In other words, if cash flows on a financial asset are not significantly different from the perfect instrument, this is consistent with the solely P&I condition. There could be an exception to this. So if the difference in cash flows is significant, but the rate is established by the regulator, it provides compensation which is broadly consistent with the passage of time. It does not create exposure to risks and variability in cash flows that is inconsistent with the basic lending type return, and there is a public policy objective behind that rate, then the boards could decide to accept that rate as a proxy for the time value of money and consider it consistent with the solely P&I condition. And just one final observation on this big box in the middle of the flowchart. prepayment features and contingent features that are consistent with the sole P&I condition and result in cash flows that are P&I are captured in this big middle box. And now moving out of this big middle box, and let's look at both Appendix A and Appendix B. And there are alternative stuff used on contingent and prepayment features that result in cash flows that are not solely P&I. Some staff believe that as long as such features are remote, it is consistent with the solely P&I condition because likely cash flows are P&I. Other staff believe that the current non-genuine threshold, which is already present in IFRS 9 and FASB exposure draft, is more appropriate, and genuine cash flows that are not P&I are inconsistent with this condition, even if such cash flows are remote. However, this staff is sympathetic to the concerns raised about financial assets acquired with significant premium or discount and prepayable at par, and therefore this staff could support an exception for just this scenario as long as fair value of the feature is insignificant. With that, I would like to turn to decision-making papers, starting with Agenda Paper 6C, Memo 243.
Hans, is this one clarifying question of Yulia? With respect to the exception, Yulia, that you cited, are you referring to an exception solely where a regulator, let's say a monetary policy board of a government, sets a term structure of interest rates that are different, let's say, than the term structure in the quote-unquote free market? Is that the only exception you're referring to? Or would the exception be broader? For example, would it also include, you know, exceptions for particular types of products in various marketplaces? I'm just trying to understand the scope of the exception.
And perhaps I could briefly answer this question, and then we could discuss it in more detail when we get on the topic of interest, but basically this exception is of a narrow scope. It only captures regulated rates, but it would capture all regulated rates where the time value component is modified. And this is regardless whether this rate is set in a free market or a more regulated market.
Okay, so you're basically referring to just the term structure of rates for that marketplace.
I don't think it's just term structure, because there's some situations where it's based on a formula, for example, that's not as... Some markets...
Or where they're modifying the term structure.
Some markets, it's the entire term structure that's modified, and some markets, it's particular products where the rate's determined based on calculations, which... I mean, it's different to, you know, the standard LIBOR-type rate, but it's not, strictly speaking, an entire term structure that's modified.
A bit of inflation, a little bit of market rate, a little bit of policy making.
But it's still a sort of monetary policy-based decision. But as you said, we'll come back to that, I think.
Countries, government, maybe through central bank, others, to allow or require some bank to offer relative lower rate for agriculture loans and mortgage loans and others. And there are so many different kinds of things.
Okay, so we now move to paper 6C, right?
Yes, memo 243, which deals with principles. That paper identified three alternatives for describing principle. And the staff recommends that the principal is described as the amount transferred by the holder for the asset on initial recognition, which is alternative C in the paper. The staff believes that this description is consistent with the economics of holding a financial assets. It's consistent with the underlying logic of the solely P&I condition, and the staff believes that this is what the board's intended. The staff knows that there are implications of this description for financial assets acquired at a premium or discount and prepayable at par, and these are discussed at the further paper. With that, I open the floor to discussion. Do the boards agree with the staff recommendation?
Did the staff guess right what we intended? Is the question.
Did they draft the wrong thing?
Did they read our mind correctly? I think they did. Any disagreements? So we okay. Alternative C, it will be.
So moving on to paper 6D, memo 244. So this paper discusses the meaning of interest, and there are three topics: de minimis features, components of interest, and time value of money. And there are questions to the board on each of these three topics. Overall, in this paper, the staff recommend that the board clarify that de minimis features are disregarded for classification, clarify the meaning of interest, and that is re-emphasize the conceptual basis, which is basic lending type return, clarify the time value of money and credit risk are not the only components which are consistent with this basic lending type return, also clarify which components are not consistent with basic lending type return and why, and also that the board clarifies the meaning of the time value of money, specifically clarify the objective, just the passage of time, clarify which factors are relevant to assessing that objective, specifically currency of the interest instrument and tenor of the interest rate, clarify that an entity can use qualitative or quantitative assessment when assessing time value component, provide guidance on the quantitative assessment and replace the not more than insignificant threshold by significant, and accept certain regulated rates as a proxy for the time value of money. So this is the overall staff recommendation, and I would like to start with the first question on de minimis features. Do you agree with the staff recommendation?
I do agree, but I have a question on paragraph 24 on the assessment of whether or not the feature is de minimis. We say you don't need to perform a quantitative analysis to prove it. That might be true, but it was observed to me that in most cases, in the discussions between the company and the auditors, it will be a bit difficult not to go into a quantitative discussion. So are we kidding ourselves in saying no quantitative, just qualitative, or are we dreaming?
This would actually, I read the last sentence to say, if you did a quantitative, you're out.
Obviously, that wasn't what we meant, but it's what we've said, I agree.
Tricia?
That's what I was going to ask about as well, particularly the last sentence that said, if you can't conclude without a quantitative analysis, that's an indicator that the feature is not de minimis, and I was wondering about how that would work in practice as well.
And if I could respond to this question maybe. So what we mean really is that a de minimis feature is so small that you don't really need to perform a quantitative analysis to conclude, but at the same time we acknowledge that in particular cases you might be required, let's say, for the regulator to support every decision that you make, in which case you might perform this analysis, but the key point is really that you don't need that analysis to conclude.
What we were trying to say was it's supposed to be something which is so inconsequential to the substance of the instrument that it's clear that it shouldn't affect the analysis, and that was the point we were trying to make.
Yeah, I understand that, but if you look at paragraph 19, it says in all scenarios it has to be immaterial de minimis, so you need really to go to great lengths to demonstrate that it is immaterial in all. Sometimes it is absolutely obvious. Sometimes it might not be so obvious that in all scenarios it will be immaterial de minimis, so how can you prove it without going to some form of quantitative analysis? I'm not saying we should change our conclusion. I'm not saying that the assertion here that you don't have to do some form of quantitative analysis might not work in reality.
Larry? That's not Russ's point is key, and that's why I would strike this last sentence and not ever have it, because effectively, if you perform a quantitative analysis, this sentence basically says you're dead.
I'd agree with you. I think our wording's unfortunate in paragraph 24.
Right. Okay.
We were just trying to make the point that it should be a feature that's
as a rule,
clearly of no substance, so you shouldn't have to think very hard, and that was really all we meant. And we've used too many words to say it.
Right. Okay.
Same exact point that Larry pointed out, that I think we should delete the last sentence, because many jurisdictions do a quantitative analysis to get to the answer. So can I just ask one question just to be myself clear? And I propose deleting it, like Larry just said. Second thing is, this is done only at the time of origination, right?
Initial recognition, yes.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to re-emphasize that it's only at origination.
Mark? I think this is necessary, or is it just defining materiality and using different words?
Yeah.
people didn't get there in our wording. We had hoped that materiality would get there, but we had so many comments from people about, does that mean that I've got this feature that's, you know, completely never going to happen, that it's going to flip the entire classification. So I would have hoped we didn't need this clarification, but based on the feedback we've got, people seem to want it.
Hal?
Yeah. I would have kept the last sentence, and instead of saying it indicates definitively, I would have just said may indicate, because I would not want people precluded from doing quantitative analysis and be confused about this. It may or may not, but do whatever quantitative analysis you need. So keep the sentence, adding? But just change it to may.
What is it adding?
Well, I think there is consensus around the table. Next issue.
Then I would like to move on to the next question on the components of interest. And so the question for the board is, do you agree with the staff recommendation on clarifying the meaning of interest?
Any questions? Tom, please.
I have two concerns. The first has to deal with paragraph 35 and the recommendation in paragraph 36D, which describes the components of interest rates that do not reflect the lending relationship, where we commonly have called it equity, commodity price components, etc. My concern is that as we move forward, we're going to be starting to evaluate in the question three area of the memo about whether differences in the tenor of the interest rates in the instrument and the reset date, whether it should be evaluated as a component of interest rate or should it be evaluated as a component of the return that is not consistent with the lending relationship. And frankly speaking, when you have differences in tenor of interest rates for the instrument and the interest rate, that's a bet on the twist in the yield curve. Because what you do is you're getting compensation for a different time period than is inherent in the instrument. And so what you're doing is betting on whether the longer or shorter yield curve compared to what the actual contractual cash flows, whether that twist gives you a return or not. I don't see that as a part of the traditional part of the lending relationship. And I would consider that a violating characteristic, not one that you would assess for whether or not the amount of the interest rate after you back out a bunch of components is consistent with the time value of money. That's issue number one. Issue number two is, I'll leave that for question three. I'll leave that for question three.
Philippe?
I fully agree with the proposal with some wording amendments. 36C. I know very few banks which lend money without trying to cover their admin costs and make some profit on top of that. For the notion that the interest could also include, I would change it to say usually includes.
Any other comments?
I had a question. It's really more in the context of what Tom raised. Is the staff planning to retain the concept that's currently in IFRS 9 with respect to describing what components represent a basic lending relationship and what doesn't? It was couched in the terms of leverage. We say that leverage is a contractual cash flow characteristic of some financial assets, and that's a no-no. Is that essentially your intent going forward still?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Does that address your concerns, Tom?
Well, I think that if it's an offending characteristic, it'd be subject to the evaluation of the de minimis constraint,
right,
rather than moving it into question three, where it would be subject to a much larger constraint that the difference is significant. And I'm finding it highly problematic to have such an unconstraining threshold when you've got a twist in the yield curve that you're betting on to say that it has to be more than a significant difference to have it be problematic. So I...
Okay. Larry?
So this is an ongoing assessment, is that correct? So...
No.
Day one.
Day one?
Yep.
Initial recognition.
I guess I don't understand that, and considering Tom's comments, how you do that for 36B. So in other words, on day one, okay, if you have a relatively flat yield curve, your, depending, you know, your reset provisions are such that it might be de minimis on day one, but if it's 3 years later and the shape of the yield curve has changed dramatically, wouldn't it then be something that could be significant or what have you? I'm sorry, go ahead, Lydia.
So this whole sort of modified time value of money assessment only kicks in when you have modified time value of money to begin with. So if you don't have interest rate mismatch feature, you don't even need to worry about it. If you do have such a feature, then you need to consider all possible scenarios and you need to consider how yield curves might develop.
Okay, so it is ongoing.
No, it's
you said you need to consider all
day
possible.
On
day one, you consider all possible.
Okay, but on day one, you know that in the future,
yes,
there might be a significant change in the shape of the yield curve such that you would flunk.
You need to consider that.
You need to consider that. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. With this clarification, do we agree with the staff recommendation?
Yeah.
Yes?
Okay, and with that, I move on to the last question in this paper on regulated rates. And the question is whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation to accept regulated rates that meet the conditions described in the paper, to accept them as a proxy for the time value of money.
That is just the question. I wouldn't disagree. I agree. However, I have a few questions about this exception. So question is, how shall we define who is the regulator? So does it include a voluntary regulation or not? Of course, it says voluntary regulation may not include it. However, so how, if that is the case, then how do you judge whether deregulation take place? Because government could announce we would deregulate, that the voluntary regulation could continue and for specific financial instrument. So my concern is scope creep. The other thing I wonder is how do you define the scope of regulations? So in the case of China, it is clear whole country is the scope of the regulation, but there are many variety of specific regulations for specific financial instruments. So how do we accept such a small regulations? And even in the case of China, like a whole country is under regulation, but foreign banks could join the market. If the foreign bank could join the market, then they are not really regulated. They have a choice. So it's quite difficult to know what is the real scope of the regulation. The other thing is the intention of the regulator. So whenever regulator make regulation, they have a clear intention. So then if the intention is just to secure the security of the investor, that is normally clear. But it is possible for the regulator to intentionally make a very strange financial instrument, a strange regulation, so that they want to secure the market itself. So then in that case, maybe we need to come back the big box again. So according to, please have a look at your flowchart. according to your flowchart, in your orange box, you have to come back to the big box again. So anyway, we have to come back to this box again. Then, my question is, if we have this rule, does it make our standard a little bit too much complicated? Because complicated. Because if you have a look at the box above, which is this shape box, so already you said it's, the judgment is significant or not. So if the regulator's intention is to significantly skew the market, then it would be ruled out this within this box. So I'm really wondering, if we decide the difference is just significant or not, if we make the higher threshold and lower threshold, then is it really necessary, taking into all those questions? So that is my question. So I do not disagree, but we need to make what I question.
Julia, you want to react? Or?
So your question is whether this exception is really necessary, considering all the other clarifications that we proposed?
Yeah, because our purpose of this proposal standard is simplification. So in order to make a simplification, we made a robust, clear standard, but we made lots of exception, and we made a flowchart which is straightforward, but it's very complicated. So flowchart comes this and this and this and this.
Do you want me to make some observations? I'll make some observations. What we're trying to do, and Tom touched on it slightly before, is that I think that we used to start having these sort of disconnects between tenor and time value, then there is actually something going on that's not, strictly speaking, just time value.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes the effects might be very small, and so they're not really going to have too much effect either on the cash flows on the instrument or have very meaningful fair value effects. And so in the normal course, if you've got a bit of variation going on, we're trying to screen for that with the significance test to try and improve the sort of reasonableness of the outcomes, to try and ensure that more instruments that people consider to be sort of simple instruments are accommodated as such, compared with how strictly IFRS 9 was interpreted. That gets us so far.
Yeah.
But we weren't really comfortable with going beyond significant, and as you know, the board initially thought more than insignificant was better, but people have said that's too fine. So we've already sort of helped a bit, I hope, if you agree to the significance change. What that doesn't do, though, is it deal with some markets where the government, for policy reasons, has come in and made quite material decisions that change the structure of interest rates in that market. Now, they haven't been done, as you're pointing to, they're usually not done with the intention of a play on interest rates, which is the sort of structure and concern if we just allowed anybody in. They're usually done with public policy objectives of some sort to try and protect investors or borrowers. And what we're trying to do is get away from intention. We don't really want to get into intention and start thinking, finding out why people did the things they did, because that's usually quite a difficult thing to do from an accounting perspective. But we do want to prevent people just structuring, to Tom's concern. And one way we thought we could sort of indirectly get an intent and reduce the structuring risk to accommodate some of these instruments, which in their markets are still considered to be fairly vanilla instruments, and where there's not really much extra information that you'd get from fair value measurement of these things, so you're not losing much information, was by trying to hinge it on regulatory policy, try and take away the avoidance risk by dealing with regulatory policy and to narrow the scope. So trying to, again, balance between something else going on in the instrument, which is the time value point which Tom legitimately raised, but still trying to keep the overall principle base as much as we can, so trying to scope it to a narrow population. And you're very right to say that's quite hard to draft, and any wording suggestions people have, if we go down this way, would be very much appreciated. But what we're trying to capture is sort of where it's a government policy, and that's all that's going on, and there's nothing added to the instrument that we think is sort of toxic, to use a pejorative term, you know, equity links, commodity links, that sort of thing. It's just about time value to try and capture that. And yes, it does add complications, but it's because we're trying to balance all of these different objectives.
So could I ask a follow-up on that? I'm testing it for purposes in the U.S. Would a regulatory action where they're not adjusting the interest rate but essentially putting their full faith and credit behind the instrument also be applicable here? So, for example, a Ginnie Mae, okay, is backed by the full faith and credit Government National Mortgage Association, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. That, in my mind, is a regulated instrument. Would that be...
We were trying to deal with variations in time value, specifically with what's proposed in the staff paper.
Okay, because I was thinking that if it's a characteristic of interest, which is credit, and they're influencing the credit of the instrument, then that would be another form of regulation, if you will, that would be acceptable.
But I think that's slightly different, because isn't that just reflected in the credit risk of the instrument? So it comes naturally from the structure of the talking about what's the component of interest anyway. So because of the nature of that instrument, because of the government support, it has a better credit risk. It has therefore a different margin, and that would just be reflected in the overall assessment.
I agree. I would think it would be acceptable.
So I don't think it's something we need to try and sort of
narrow it up.
Okay.
Yes. Just respond to Sue's point. I agree. All what you said. However, we have lowered the threshold to the significant level. So actually, it really achieved quite a lot of the problems. And if the regulation makes the very significant difference, I wonder whether we should go that down the path. So therefore, if we have a significant, maybe we can achieve a lot of it. And the one thing my concern is, you said structuring would not take place, but I don't think so. Because if the other participants can join that market, they have a choices. If they cannot participate, then fine. So therefore, we have to draft it very carefully, craft it very carefully. So my concern is, normally, regulation takes place in the case of financial crisis. And in the case of financial crisis, regulator could do anything they like. And then they would regulate the market itself. And then my concern is, because of that rule, it would create another structuring opportunity. And taking all these consideration, we have significant threshold already here. So how should we make this rule such complicated?
Can I try?
Mark? It's a different point. Yes. My question and concern is paragraph 52. You talked about the qualitative analysis for the time value of money, and this is similar to my point before. I think you got to give them something to shoot at other than just is it useful information. And I in fact would make the objective of the qualitative analysis the same as the objective for the quantitative analysis that you had in 54. You're just trying to get a sense of whether or not it's going to be that different from just the passage of time. If it's equity linked, et cetera, you don't have to go through a whole quantitative analysis. It's obviously not just for the passage of time. But you got to give them something up to shoot for other than is cost going to give you useful information. I just think that's not a threshold really for an entity to come up with. Jim?
Tuck raised the issue of whether we're creating undue complexity, which, you know, each one of these, I feel like I agree with the staff recommendation. I do here, but I just wanted to put out a marker that in my mind, agreeing individually on each one of these doesn't mean that I'm going to agree to the model, because then I take a step back and say, what have we built? And I don't know if this is the time for that discussion versus going through, but didn't want to leave the impression that agreeing to each of these means I agree with what we're building.
Okay. Philippe?
Yes, I wanted to respond to TAC. I think we are dealing with products which are regulated. A product is being regulated by public policy reasons, by an agency. It's not only in times of crisis, it's a permanent feature. That's the first point. Second point, I think the qualitative assessment that is discussed here just before paragraph 63, that is that this regulation doesn't introduce exposure to risk or volatility that are inconsistent with basic lending, I think we would keep it, wouldn't we? So I think that would eliminate most of the concerns that TAC has about very strange products like equity kickers in a basic lending would not go, because there is by nature something which creates volatility which is inconsistent with lending. So we are just qualitatively speaking dealing with interest rate reset or mismatches in terms of timing and not with very structured and complex products.
Mary?
In terms of the staff recommendations, I think it's helpful to move from not more than insignificant to, you know, clear reference to significant, because I think the notion that there were these three zones of not more than insignificant zone and significant was challenging. I'd look in 63D if we could express it perhaps a bit more straightforward. You know, should be insignificant, could not, you know, it, right now it could not be more than significantly different, which just seems a overly complex way to do it. And can I just check my understanding in terms of 63E, which is not allow a fair value option, that what the staff considered but is recommending we do not pursue is saying another reason why you could elect fair value P&L is even if there's not an accounting mismatch to avoid the complexity of the quantitative analysis that you'd have to do to show. Okay, I just wanted to make sure that it's the you don't have to meet the requirement. It would give you relief from the requirement to have an accounting mismatch. Just be another reason you could get into fair value. Okay. That's fine. It isn't that the instrument is forever precluded. It's just you can't use this basis for getting into fair value.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is forever precluded in the sense that you only do the fair value option on initial recognition, so you need to make your mismatch decision.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't prevent it from...
It doesn't from another reason.
Right.
Larry?
So... Actually, I was going to cover the exact same points as Mary, but I'm not sure I totally understand. In 63D, where you say the contractual cash flows could not be more, you mean based upon historical, you know, experience or history or what have you, or, I mean, is it possible that something could... you know, the yield curve could, the steepness of it could be very unreasonable in light of historical patterns, but yet it might happen. Yep. I mean, so what, I think we need to, if you don't intend that, then I think you need to use different words than could not be.
We've taken that wording from the double test, so the same sort of philosophy there that you need to think about what might happen, not just what your sort of expected scenarios are. It's a broader analysis.
Perspective as well.
So that's what we've tried to align it with.
In the most extreme of circumstances. Yeah, I mean, that's my problem. In real extreme circumstances, who knows what can happen?
Is it genuine then? If it is the most extreme, does it genuine assessment eliminate that most extreme?
I mean, would you rather have a probability assessment? Is it not, is it probable that this will not occur or something like that?
So the guidance right now asks you to consider only reasonably possible scenarios. So if you have an extreme scenario, you disregard that for this analysis.
And
so it's reasonably possible. So there is a problem.
You intend to carry that forward in implementation guidance? Is that what you're saying?
But the shape of the yield curve is highly volatile. I mean, if you look at it historically over time, it changes rapidly. You can have contango situations where the short-term interest rates are higher than the long-term interest rates. You can have an extremely steep yield curve, and you can have a more traditional one. And that happens regularly. I think almost anything's reasonably possible when you look at the shape of the yield curve economically over time.
That was my concern.
No, that wasn't what I was going to say. That's not what this was up for. Okay. I think the staff's made a really solid effort to try to make an operable comp comparison, but I don't think it's going to be effective. Think what we're asking them to do. Take the interest rate, deduct from it an estimate of profit margin, deduct from it an estimate for return on cost, deduct it from it an estimate of credit risk, and deduct from it an estimate of liquidity risk to come up with time value of money. Then identify what the ideal time value of money would be on an instrument. All of those judgments are subject to lots of variability that you can insert in the judgments. And so if I came down and made some of those judgments and I found that the yield curve on the ideal instrument versus the base instrument was significantly different, I think there's enough variability in all those components that you just go back and change them so that they aren't significantly different. And I don't know how anyone has the ability to challenge what a reasonable profit margin is, what a reasonable compensation for cost is, what the ideal time value of money is in that calculation. And credit risk compensation and liquidity risk can be highly variable. And so I think the outcome of making people go through this is going to be something that's extremely challengeable, auditing. And effectively, in most instances, the result will be any change in interest rates are okay. Any modification in interest rates are okay. Is that what we're seeking in this process? Because I'm pretty confident that that's the outcome. And we're going to have a lot of challenges in the audit environment about the tests.
So you think we went from a closed door to opening it too wide?
No door.
No
door. So what could you do? What could you do then? Some of you?
Well, I wouldn't put them through all this calculation if we're going to say any modification in interest rates is okay. But I'm not comfortable with the conclusion that every modification in interest rates is okay if I go back to the original paper of the objective of amortized cost. And it embedded bets on interest rate curves, introducing volatility that's not compensation simply for lending.
You have the same problem. As you start from the total interest or you deduct things which are estimates, you cannot prove it either.
Well, that was the point.
But would we have two tests. We have a cash flow characteristics test and then we have a business model test. And would the requirements of the business model test effectively be sufficient to alleviate your concern over the wideness of the cash flow characteristics test?
I can't answer that until I know what we do with business model. Because right now I think we're wide open in being able to let somebody assert they're going to cash collect things without defining the business models better. I don't think value realization is a business model. It is the outcome of managing certain risks within a business model that I will more likely cash collect or more likely sell. Right now we've got a business model that says I intend to cash collect, and every instrument, financial asset that we have, you start off cash collecting, even in the trading book.
Right, but if you, and I'm not trying to change the subject matter to business model, but if you start selling, doesn't that draw into question your assertions that you're holding it to cash collect?
Yes, but in every one of those models, we let you sell.
Larry, is your point the more
the more additional things that are in the instrument, the more likely management's going to manage that by selling. Is that what you're saying?
No, my point is just the opposite. The more you allow into past the cash flow characteristics test, then the more importance there is in terms of evaluating the business model and being confident that sales that are not because of a realignment of your business or what have you are not appropriate, and then therefore people would question your assertions on a go-forward basis, taking into consideration our view of Kingdom. That's all.
There you go.
Yesterday during small group meetings, I mentioned one point which may relate to what Tom said. I don't want to say whether it's okay or not. My understanding is we set principles how you should do. But in reality, I don't think companies or banks will assess their interest rate, whether it's qualified or not, principal interest, whether it's qualified or not qualified, by slicing different pieces. You know, I don't think in reality company or auditors will go through the process. I don't think so.
Someone asked what I would do, I go back to clearly and closely related. I'd go back to defining cash flow characteristics based on clearly and closely related, because we know the magnitude of the change that is creates.
Including the rules associated with those.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the double test, all those other sorts of things. I know they're complicated, but people know how to do it now.
But I think from the FASB and the ISB, obviously in very different positions there, given we already have IFRS 9 and you don't have that at the moment. So my understanding was that once we finish the P&I discussion, you'll have a separate discussion on whether you want to move to that model or whether clearly and closely related works better for you. I think from an IFRS 9 perspective, we haven't had that many application questions in terms of the application of solely P&I, other than clarifications on what principal meant, which we've agreed on, and this time value of money, how much give would we give on that, and our clarifications we're talking about today would address those two issues. I think there's been less of a concern on IFRS perspective of the sort of slicing and dicing point, I think because of the point Waigwo makes, which is generally people aren't going to think about it that way. They're going to look at the features and see if there's anything obvious they need to test, but otherwise they're not concerned. But obviously we're coming from a different starting point.
We're introducing a new approach here too. Exactly. I mean, previously, if anything, there's it's more easily violated and things are pushed up to fair value, profit and loss, and we're trying to ease it back. And
but isn't this key in terms of your ability to evaluate beneficial interests? No?
What beneficial interests?
Well, investments. Investments in hybrid instruments. Aren't the answers to these key in terms of how you evaluate those? No?
I'm not sure.
For debt equity splits?
Well, I just don't know what kind of provisions might be in them. I thought that the responses to these would help evaluate those situations. Maybe I'm wrong.
Whether there's an embedded derivative and whether you have to move the whole instrument to fair value, profit and loss is what he's talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, obviously they are relevant, but I think that by clarifying the components of interest, by clarifying what principal means, and by giving more clarity on time value, I think we've addressed most of the questions people have had around hybrid instruments from an IFRS perspective. I think the whole regulatory environment always comes into these discussions. It's just a different level of scrutiny.
I agree with you, Tom. Tom, I understand your sensitivity, but I actually think that if the way in which the investor is going to be compensated here has any kind of element of leverage associated with it, where that interest rate is not essentially tied to, you know, the time value of money and credit and liquidity, and I think those things are identifiable. I think every investor.
I liquidity and credit you can probably identify. But say they put a leverage component in it, and the person just asserts that extra percentage is profit margin, or it's return for cost. Well, how are you going to challenge it?
You're right. You're not going to be able to, and that would presumably pass the test. But that would be associated with a basic lending relationship. And if they can do that in that market and they can get away with it, well, then the more power to them. I've seen a lot of, you know, finance companies do that for years, charge people exorbitant amounts of money for, you know, small amount of loans, installment loans. And you know, in the United States, there are usury laws that obviously try to stop that, but it's acceptable.
Well, so, the profit margin, if there's any, suggests you look at the market. So anything that gives you a huge rate, either maybe compensation for credit, or there's a market that accepts it, right? And the profit margin on credit cards tends to be pretty large if you don't pay. Now, is that compensation for credit risk or profit margin? But if you're going to try to evaluate that, I think you get a clear pass.
Well, perhaps is it useful to have a separate vote on these two boards on this question?
Yes. So on question three.
Question three. Then I see ISB who supports staff recommendation.
6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. FESB.
I think we need to pause because yeah. I think part of the debate, and I agree with Sue that the ISB and the FESB are in different places about the test of solely principal and interest. In the context of only working through a model related to solely principal and interest, knowing we will subsequently at a meeting evaluate do we want to continue the clearly and closely related concept or move to a solely principal and interest. So just in this context, so
individual decision,
taking D off the table, the FASB, who would agree with A, B, C, E and F, and then I'll ask D.
What is?
I'm just trying to isolate where the concern may be. I'm in paragraph 63, the staff's recommendation. I didn't hear any issue related to A. The debate I heard was D, but I want to just confirm that.
I would throw F into it, but.
Oh, okay. So
part of my concern ties back to the other issue I raised previously. If the twist in the yield curve bet became an offending characteristic, there'd be far less leverage or stuff in here to be problematic to me. But we left the twist in the yield curve is okay. That is, you're betting on the twist in yield curve, and that's a part of a normal lending relationship, and then you have to be able to look at that sort of bet as to being more than significant in the context of measuring all these other components.
So, Tom, isn't that related to D? Because in D, we are raising the threshold from not more than significant to
right,
significant.
That's D.
That's part of it. Part of it's the threshold, but part of it's really should it ever be in the consideration here? Should it be just a de minimis feature threshold?
Okay. Oh, okay. So
that's a big change.
Well, that's what IFRS 9 was.
So. Back to the vote. We're okay. A, B, C, and E. Any objections in the FASB to A, B, C, and E? None. Okay. With respect to F, anybody disagree with F? One, two? Okay. With respect to D, who agrees with D? The FASB.
So. I agree with the idea. If it could be operationalized, I'm not sure people know what a perfect rate is, whether it can be applied, but the notion that it would let through traditional lending,
okay,
it doesn't concern me.
Do you have that same observation, Tom, that your primary concern on D about the operationality of D?
Yes, mm-hmm. That would be mine.
Okay. So I think what we're saying is we need some more analysis if we were to go down this path about what are some of the operational issues in the U.S. capital markets around applying D. So we're not rejecting D. We're just going to further evaluate D. Is that fair?
But
I have healthy skepticism that it could ever be made operational.
So, Tom, do you also have concern about the threshold, or is it only the operationality at this threshold?
Well, it's a double problem.
Okay.
I mean, if we lowered the threshold, it would be far less of a concern.
Yeah, okay. I think some type of probability notion or something like that has to be embedded in your consideration.
So we can take that offline and deal with that.
Okay, very good. Julia?
So we got a question with
Raul. Thank you. So with that, we will move on to ISB Agenda Paper 60 and FASB Memo 245, which discusses the application of solely P&I condition to a contingent features. The FASB's proposal requires an entity to consider both nature of a contingent trigger event and the resulting cash flows to assess solely P&I conditions. IFRS 9, however, does not contain an explicit guidance on assessing contingent features, but states that a contractual term that changes the timing or amount of principal and interest do not result in cash flows that are solely P&I unless it is a variable rate that is consideration for the time value of money and credit risk. Overall, respondents noted that in their view, there are a number of common contingent features that will result in the financial asset not meeting the solely P&I condition and being classified entirely at fair value P&L, even if the fair value of the contingent feature is insignificant. This paper discusses contingent features that result in solely cash flows, solely P&I cash flows, and contingent features that result in non-solely P&I cash flows in separate sections and ask questions to the board in each of those sections. For contingent features that result in solely P&I cash flows, the paper discusses whether the nature of the trigger event in itself should impact the classification, whether the board intended a different approach for trigger events related to contingent prepayment and extension features and those related to other types of contingent features, and the assessment of punitive rate in classification. On the first issue of whether nature of the trigger event in itself should impact the classification of a financial asset, the paper explains that it is appropriate and indeed necessary to consider both the trigger event and the resulting cash flows in combination to determine whether the contractual cash flows on the financial assets are solely P&I. Therefore, the paper proposes to clarify the guidance that the nature of the trigger event in itself is not a determinative factor in assessing whether the contractual cash flows are solely P&I throughout the life of the instrument. However, it is a helpful indicator in assessing whether the cash flows are solely P&I. The paper further discusses the staff's view that the board did not intend the guidance for contingent prepayment and extension features to be different compared to the guidance for other types of contingent features. Rather, the guidance on contingent prepayment and extension feature represent examples of triggers that were expected to typically result in cash flow that are solely P&I. Accordingly, the paper recommends that the boards clarify that. On interest rate that some describe as punitive, the paper acknowledges that the specific example of a punitive rate included in the FASB's proposed ASU may indeed suggest that any rate that could be considered punitive in nature does not meet the solely P&I condition because it does not appropriately reflect consideration for the time value of money, credit risk, and liquidity risk of the financial asset. However, consistent with the analysis in the paper and clarification of interest that we just discussed, the paper proposes that the guidance on punitive rate should be updated to reflect if a punitive interest rate is consistent with the notion of interest, it should not result in instrument failing the solely P&I condition. Therefore, the first question the staff would like to ask the board is that do the board agree with the staff recommendation that the guidance on assessment of contingent features that result in cash flow that are solely P&I should be clarified as just discussed? With that, I will turn it over to the board for discussion.
Harry,
one question.
I'll kick it off and say that, well, without kind of getting into the, should we introduce this notion of remote?
That's second question.
Right. That I did actually have some concerns about the idea of saying the nature of the trigger doesn't matter, because I think the example that you gave in the paper of an equity index hitting a certain level being the trigger, to me, just is disconnected from the lending relationship notion. And I think that the idea that, to me, many payments or consequences can be expressed in terms of their effect on principle or interest. And so saying we don't focus on the nature of the trigger, but instead just look at whether the resulting impact have a principle or interest nature, to me, that doesn't gel. I think I would say that the trigger is, the nature of the trigger is important, and that it be conforming be a necessary but not sufficient condition for a payment to be considered SPPI. So what I mean by necessary but not sufficient is if you have the equity index trigger, that kicks you out. If it's an acceptable, you know, nature of trigger, that's not enough to support a conclusion. You then have to look at the, you know, the consequence, what the impact is on the trigger, on the cash flows.
How would you describe what was an acceptable trigger and what's an unacceptable trigger?
I think I would go back to I can see triggers that relate to covenants in the debt in a debt agreement, for example. But I think it qualitative. I don't have a formula for you, but I was not comfortable with the notion of saying we view the trigger as merely an indicator about the nature of the cash flows, because I think so many things could be expressed as, and the interest rate triples. You know, that's still, many people would say, interest. But is a tripling of an interest rate an appropriate sanction for, you know, for the event? I think you're just kicking the...
But to be clear, it wouldn't be enough to label it as interest. You'd then need to go back and consider, based on what we've just agreed about, what is an interest, by all Tom's consent, to satisfy yourself that resulting number is...
I think it just piles up the pressure on that.
Martin?
Well, I agree with staff recommendation because, man, for example, if the trigger is also equity index, but it is said, okay, you're coming from a fixed rate to an variable rate, but this variable rate is really only time value of money and credit risk, I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I think the trigger is not really in, should not be the dividing factor here, but it could be an indicator. I agree with staff, because if it is odd, then maybe you have to look more in detail, but it is not, I think, any kind of trigger which is, I think, not related to interest rate should result in that then the P&I is not resolved, because that is a good example. If equity or whatever, but if really then it would change to a variable interest rate which has all the elements which we discussed some minutes ago, I think that's okay.
I think I just get hung up on what does an equity index hitting a certain level have to do with a lending relationship? You know, that
I don't know. And that is the reason why it is a good indicator. Maybe there is, and then you have to look more in detail.
I basically support staff proposal and Martin's comments. You know, I understand the concern from Mary. Maybe we now here. Please look at paragraph 23. You know, here you use a not a determinative factor. I agree. You know, Mary wants label it as necessary. I do not agree. And then you said helpful indicator, maybe the change into important indicator, I would agree too. And but say, you know, the nature will deny you or not, I don't see it as appropriate. And Martin gave very good examples, and staff have other examples, like you are going to IPO if you're successful, and you will keep the current interest rate. If not, let's assume, you know, we'll charge you a normal market rate. Or previously offer you a preferential rate, relatively lower than market rate, but if you meet some conditions or not meet some conditions, we'll charge you purely market rate. Why not? I think I fully agree with Martin.
Do I sense... Oh, Tom.
I think Mary has brought up an important issue. In side conversation with the staff, we've discussed and they've given me some input in terms of how certain instruments might be evaluated within this memo. And for instance, they've described an instrument that the financial, we talked about an instrument where the financial asset is issued with a fixed interest rate that is reset to another fixed interest rate based on an equity index. And they end up saying that's not okay because you got an offending component that drives the change, equity index. But then turn around and we discussed another instrument where the fixed asset that is issued with a fixed rate that's below market is reset to a market rate if the issuer achieves a specified revenue target. And the determination was, I believe, the revenue target, the equity index target's bad. It's outside the lending relationship, but the revenue target it is not. And as long as you move to a market rate, it's okay. At least the conclusion in that discussion was that in that setting, you meet the solely principal and interest issue, and it's only the issue as to whether the next rate is close to market or not, and then it's okay. If that's the case, I think the trigger matters. I don't understand why we would get out of this memo a difference if the trigger is based on an equity index versus a trigger based on a revenue target. Those both seem to be changes in return that are dependent on things that aren't consistent with the lending relationship. Now, if that's not the outcome, then the discussions I had with the staff are not germane, but I think Mary's bringing up a key point. If there is a difference between those two instruments.
Where's the revenue target example? Where is the revenue target example?
That's talking to the staff.
It was in discussions with the staff at our ed session, we asked for some feedback about how this would be applied to specific types of instruments, and the follow-on discussion of that had those conclusions.
Yeah.
So perhaps if I could respond to that, I think in the education session we did not really look to arrive to any definitive conclusions on any instruments. Rather, we were discussing examples, and I think we certainly didn't mean to say that an equity trigger is not okay, but a revenue trigger is okay. I think all we were trying to do is to provide different examples, give you different examples with different fact patterns. That would illustrate that you need to consider your financial asset holistically and consider all relevant facts and circumstances in order to arrive to the conclusion whether it's consistent with the solely P&I. And if my memory serves me well, the example with the revenue trigger to which you are referring, it was an example, and I think it's actually included in the contingencies paper as well. This is an example where you have a startup company and you are given a favorable financing to begin with, and once they hit a particular sort of EBITDA revenue trigger and they start making revenue, then the rate resets at the market level. So essentially you have a combination of just below market rate and the market rate. And so our conclusion was that, you know, even though this is based on revenues, that in itself will not always necessarily result in the whole instruments being at fair value through P&L. But we, and you know, I will chime in. Yeah.
So to summarize, the proposed ASU said that if the trigger is bad, you just stop. That's it. What we are saying is, if the trigger is bad, you still have another step to see whether the trigger doesn't mess up with your P&I cash flows. That's all we are trying to clarify here. If it doesn't, even if the trigger is bad, if it doesn't mess up your solely P&I, you are still okay. That's the
equity index conclusion that you provided in the discussion wouldn't automatically be violating, even though that's what the conclusion was when we discussed it?
In other words, how Martin described it. Yeah. Martin basically took Mary's situation of having an equity contingency, hitting it, but yet the reset rate would pass. His interpretation was that you're okay.
Right.
Then why do you need to consider the contingent provision whatsoever? All you have to do is consider whether the interest being charged is appropriate, period.
Exactly. And that's all at the start of saying.
That's all we're saying, then let's phrase the question.
That's all we're saying, and all we're doing is reacting to the fact that because we had a list of sort of acceptable prepayment
triggers in the document, people came back and said, why isn't this on there, or why is this on there? And so we're going to get into a debate about what should be in the list. And so rather than having a list, we'd rather build on the principle, and that's really all we're trying to do.
Right. So an equity index is irrelevant to the decision.
Yes.
As long as interest is properly.
Yes. So which is
within these
which is different from saying that you have to look holistically at the two in combination. What you're really saying is the trigger doesn't matter.
Right.
It is the P&I that results that matters.
I mean, it should not.
That the trigger might give an indication of something.
Yes, it's an indicator. It should not be completely disregarded. However, it doesn't impact. If it doesn't impact your cash flow, you should.
The conclusion, it depends.
I wouldn't say it that way because you're just going to confuse people. Because, you know, if people look at the nature of the contingency by itself and equity, it's an equity index or whatever, people are going to say automatically that should blow you out. But yet, as long as the interest rate is appropriate, you're saying it's okay. Don't confuse them. Just say, look at the reset interest rate. Is it okay? Period.
Yeah, and at the most, the nature of the trigger might give some indication, but it's the other thing that matters.
Now let me give you an example, Larry. So the other example would be the trigger is I convert my debt into equity. It's a convertible instrument. That's what trigger is doing. In that case, you have no cash flows to look at. The trigger itself, it gets you out because.
So do the cash flows. If you convert into an equity instrument, you're out.
That's because the cash flows aren't.
If the cash flows are always okay, you're okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Why don't we just say that?
Yeah. But I think that I feel the staff did this way because if you took a flow chart, not to tease Larry here, but if you take a flow chart, look at the trigger. Is there a trigger? Yes. Whatever is a trigger. Then you look at the next step. Is this relating to a reset of interest? It is not relating to reset of interest. So I kind of comfortable with the SAS flow of thing here because it made sense to me. Look at it holistically. You need to consider trigger as one of the criteria. That's all the staff is saying. Don't just blindly look at the trigger and be done with it. You need to ultimately stop at interest. So the flow chart, Larry, is that I move to one direction. Is it interest? You said, yeah, it is. Then I'm done. I think the trigger is starting the interest reset, so I got to think about trigger.
It matters which box you put first on the flow chart.
No, but with Larry, I put trigger first.
Okay. I think
you're okay.
This is sufficiently clear now.
I think we killed it.
Do we support the staff's recommendation that...
As
clarified in the discussion.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. So the second part of this paper discusses contingent features that result in cash flow that are not solely P&R. The paper presents three alternatives for the board's consideration. Alternative A proposes to retain the existing guidance in IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed ASU. Under that guidance, a feature that results in cash flow that are not solely P&I will be inconsistent.
Excuse me. I think this is going to take a bit longer. Would you like to take a break before we get into this? Yeah?
Yeah.
Let's.